That's the point. Thank you.
Hi there. Thank you, Your Honor, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Amy Winston. I'm a practicing dentist. I'm also the director of dentistry at Swedish Medical Center. And I'd like to speak to you about a perhaps lesser known, maybe not obvious, community benefit Swedish provides and how that directly relates to the Cherry Hill campus. So back in 2010, the Washington State Legislature cut the funding for adult dental Medicaid. That was a huge crisis. There were obviously big budget problems in our state budget, but that left a very, very big hole for vulnerable adults in our state. And at the time, the Seattle King County Dental Society, of which I'm a very active member, was looking for solutions. They were looking for community partners to figure out how to close this hole so that patients wouldn't end up in the hospital or in even worse situations. So in looking for community partners, the Dental Society came to Swedish, and Swedish stepped up. Swedish stepped up in a really, really big way. I would like you to know that there are only two hospitals in the state of Washington that have and support dental services, dental clinics within the hospital. One is Children's Hospital, and that, of course, is limited to pediatric populations. There's no adult care rendered there. So Swedish stepped up by building a clinic within our First Hill campus. That clinic is for underfunded adults. In order to qualify for this clinic, one must meet 200% of the poverty level or below. And at that clinic, we provide surgical care at no cost to patients. And so what that means is a lot of extractions, a lot of full mouth extractions, a lot of wisdom teeth extractions, things that are truly critical to a person's medical well-being. Since that time, we have grown that clinic as far as we have exceeded our capacity of what we originally thought. In 2014, we provided over $2 million worth of care to underserved patients. This year, as of May, we have already provided $1 million of care, so we will exceed that this year. That dental clinic has three dental chairs. We are booked out 6 weeks. Many of these patients have nowhere else to go other than a local emergency room. So that's what we're doing at the First Hill campus. I'd like to comment that Swedish makes no profit on that clinic, zero. In fact, they lose money on the overhead of this clinic. The sole purpose of this clinic is community benefit. And I can say that because I'm actively involved and I see what happens there. This last year in 2014, the dental service began talking with the Swedish administration about building a bigger clinic and offering more services to the underserved. We identified the Cherry Hill campus as a site that we would like to build a 3,500 square foot clinic. We know in that area the resources for adult Medicaid patients are incredibly limited, and we felt that we could offer something to the community in a very, very nice way. And instead of just providing extractions, we wanted to be able to provide general dental services so people will have more of a chance at preventative, routine, comprehensive care. We had a lot of support from the administration at Swedish. We developed a business plan. We started looking for space at the Cherry Hill campus. Again, we identified that campus primarily for the community around it. We knew that the dental resources in that community were incredibly limited. We looked high and low. We looked, we were searching through broom closets, hallway space. Where can we find space for this dental clinic? And the answer was we couldn't. The hospital was full. And unfortunately, that plan has been shelved at the moment because we have nowhere to put that clinic. So I would submit to you that dentistry is not an obvious service line in a hospital. It's not something people think of, and nor did Swedish have any obligation to be able to build this clinic and support our services, but they have. They've done it in a really, really big way, and that's what I wanted to come here to discuss.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Richter.
I think just one line of conversation.
Okay, go ahead, Mr.
Richter, I think You were testifying about the EIS and what you referred to as a transposed list of a menu of possible improvements that could be implemented in the neighborhood to deal with pedestrian and vehicular issues.
That was one of my comments, yes.
Right, right. And I think with respect to that in particular, you said that it was your observation that while there was a list here, it was not accompanied by any obligation to actually build these at any particular time or any particular one of them. Is that right?
That is my recollection, yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm looking at the list here, and you tell me, but I assume that that the construction of pedestrian bulbs at 18th and Cherry, if it were required, would be a good thing. Only if it were required.
If you would kindly point me to the portion of the EIS that states that Swedish will build those.
Well, no, I'm not doing that. I'm just asking you right now. If it were required, it would be a good thing.
I object. And the reason I object is because we don't know what's actually going to happen on 18th Avenue as it relates to whether it's going to be a greenway or not. And there was testimony that said it was not such a good idea to put bulbs on 18th if it becomes where you're going to have a bikeway.
I will shift to 17th.
All right. He will rephrase his question.
Okay. So let me
rephrase. What are you looking at? What page?
I will get to that in just
a second.
Okay. So looking at 17th and Cherry, would it be a positive thing in your mind and helpful from a mitigation point of view if Swedish were required to construct a pedestrian bulb out at that intersection?
I think it would depend. Right now, Cherry is it features parking on one side of the street, which is reversible in order to accommodate traffic flows. So if there was a bulb out that would actually restrict the ability of that corridor to handle commute-level traffic during the afternoons where I believe traffic is parking is prohibited on that one to allow extra space. So potentially, the construction of the bulbs, while it might have a positive impact on pedestrian safety at that particular intersection, if it was found that there was a high volume of pedestrians at that intersection, which there's not, there would be additional impacts that are not studied inside the EIS and cannot be determined with that document.
So let me back up to a comment you made a couple minutes ago, Mr. Richter, that you were, you asked me if I could indicate to you a location at which Swedish was required to construct any of these improvements off the transpo menu. Is that right?
I believe my direct comment was that the text of that document, if you flip to the previous page, that you have there at the bottom, the final paragraph there where it says who will bear responsibility for implementing that indicates that Swedish is committed to discussing it with SDOT and determining some level of responsibility which is not necessarily known and or committed to at this point. It's not the same as Children's, which says we commit, we shall build these improvements, we will contribute $3.7 million to SDOT in order to achieve these particular outcomes and these particular things. So you're talking about hypotheticals. And hypothetically, if there is one on there that where you're required to do it as a mitigation effort, as part of your ongoing, and might I add, very recently constructed improvements along that 17th Avenue pedestrian corridor, that's already said and done. That's probably already, I'm guessing, and you're free to clarify that. Is that a commitment that's already been made to SDOT?
Let me ask
prior to the MIP.
Actually, he's going to ask you the question.
I'm going to ask you the question.
You don't get to ask.
So as part of your scope, the review of the DPD director's report in this matter? Or are you focusing on the EIS?
I have reviewed both. That is correct.
And it was your testimony, just to clarify, on direct, and I just asked you at the beginning, that there's nothing in that list that you referred to that was actually required to be constructed.
In the EIS, there's no direct communication about that.
Right.
It is true that the director's report did modify that.
Oh, it is. Oh, so I'm handing you what is page 108 of the director's report. And do you see that list?
I do.
Yeah, and can you read the heading at the top of the list?
Capital improvements required prior to issuance of certificate of occupancy.
So would it be your judgment that prior to a certificate of occupancy for a project that these improvements need to be constructed?
Well, that would naturally follow, yes.
Okay. So now, just a reminder, your testimony earlier, I think, on direct and then at the beginning of our cross, was that there was nothing on that list that was required to be constructed. Do you want to amend that testimony?
In light of this, yes, there's a limited subset that will be constructed.
I don't know.
Mr. Brogan?
Yeah, I just have two questions, please. Mr. Richter, I'm Joseph Brogan, counsel for Swedish Medical Center. Just two questions for you. Very early on in your testimony, you testified that the use of the plaza area on the Cherry Hill campus as open space allowed greater lot coverage. And could you explain the basis for your statement in that respect?
I believe what I said is that the plaza was originally presented to the CAC, and it has been most likely since amended. The original map that was presented to the CAC of the open space indicated that the entire plaza would be considered open space, including the driveway components. The CAC objected to this, and as a result, there were many conversations about this at the CAC meeting in terms of whether or not this is required. It was Swedish position that, or at least it was the position communicated to the CAC that Swedish considered the entire plaza to be open space, and that the open space requirement connects with the floor area ratio and lot coverage.
Okay. You explain what you mean by connects with?
Well, you can, in order, there is a certain percentage, of which in this particular case is actually very high compared to other campuses in the area. There's a certain percentage of the total campus area which must be left for open space. And the question was whether or not it is usable open space or whether or not it is just open space. And I believe, as part of my research into that particular question, was that driveways were prohibited from being included as part of that open space. Again, this is the final document here does indicate that the plaza is not considered open space, but that was not always the case. And it took a fair amount of effort on the part of the CAC to have that particular instance amended and changed.
My question was, do you maintain your testimony that use or designation of this plaza as open space allows greater lot coverage on this campus?
If the lot coverage is a function of open space and the plaza is considered to be open space, then that would count towards the percentage that is open space and therefore allow a coverage that is greater than if that was excluded from it.
Do you happen to know under DPD regulations whether the plaza is in fact counted in lot coverage?
Again, I'm basing this on the documents that were presented to me as a CAC member by Swedish and the images that were contained within that. So whether or not the technical specifications, no, but the attempt was to incorporate both that and also the open space that was located on property not controlled by Swedish and or Sabi in the calculation of lot coverage.
Do you know what the institution is proposing in terms of lot coverage for the master plan?
I only have what's available in the EIS and...
do you know that number?
The exact number?
Yes.
I'm sure we can reference it.
I'm not asking if we can reference it. I'm asking if you know the number.
at this, whatever the number is, the point is that if you include the plaza as open space, that increases the square footage of the open space, which allows you to squeeze out open space in other areas.
Let's move on. One final question. Your testimony was that in your opinion, the residential parking zone, or RPZ, that exists somewhere in the vicinity of this campus, was not being enforced diligently. Is that correct?
That has been my experience and the experience of others.
And are you familiar with the job responsibilities of the Swedish parking ambassador at Cherry Hill?
As a point of clarification, can I ask when this employee was hired and why I would be privy to their...
You can answer my question first.
Don't ask
questions. Sorry.
If you can answer, if not, just tell me that you don't know.
No. I'm aware that... Yeah, no.
Okay. Are you aware that the Swedish parking ambassador who was retained in February of 2015 is in fact... That's charged with assisting with the neighborhood parking.
I object.
Don't answer. What's your objection?
Well, you're presenting a fact that is not in evidence.
It is in evidence.
I've not heard it. I don't recall when it was said.
The testimony that the component of the transportation management plan includes a parking ambassador who is, as their primary responsibility, is to work with the neighborhood to resolve RPZ parking issues.
That's the transportation management plan.
But the witness testified he doesn't know about the ambassador.
That's fine. No further questions.
Well, actually,
no further questions.
All right. Do you have any questions?
Just two clarifying questions,
yes.
And they're yes, no answers.
Okay.
Yes, no answers.
Okay.
Okay. When I asked you to speak in context of the questions I asked, did I ask that it was about the EIS document?
Yes.
I don't need to ask any other questions.
Thank you. All right, we'll go to Mr. Richter's public testimony. Did you have another witness?
No. I had made a mistake the other day by not asking to enter the resume of Ms. Adman and Mr. Kindred into the record when they testified.
Exhibits 19 and 20. And those are the exact things that you have referenced.
Kindred is being marked as 19 and Adman as 20.
Thank you very much. And that is all that I had.
Thank you. All right, public testimony. You can tell me about the MIMP.
All right, the muzzle gets to come off.
Be nice.
Yeah. So once again, my name is Nicholas Richter. I have always planned to be here today as a member of the CAC, speaking in support of or against the eventual plan that was created or that came out of the public participation process that I participated on for the majority of the process until a job took me elsewhere. I moved to California last year to pursue a career in transportation and take on that particular area. My experience with this plan and my judgment of this plan is that it is a deeply flawed document and that it does not represent the full range, an analysis of the full range of possibilities that could have been for this campus. There was a very much a tunnel vision or blinders that were put on in terms of the alternatives that were presented to CAC. And the CAC maintained very early on and continued to maintain throughout the process that we wanted to see more, that the alternatives that were presented to us didn't really fit the bill, that they were too much, that they were, that the types of expansion of the campus was not only unreasonable and unrealistic and should have been judged as unrealistic prior to it even being presented to us, but actually ended up being harassing towards near neighbors. The is very important to me to mention the public process and the content, because the Seattle Code requires that the MIP be developed with significant public input and with significant influence from the CAC, and that Swedish listen to the CAC and seriously take that into consideration. During my time on there, we did have many discussions, but these were all focused around the alternatives that were presented. There was always a question at every meeting, at almost every instance where the question was, well, this is okay, but we would like to see something different. Swedish never consulted with us. They never followed up. They never tried to really get our input on taking these into consideration. And when they did, like, for example, Alternative 4, which proposes an expansion boundary to include the current DHSH building, that was in direct response to my input. I was the one who actually advocated for that. I'm also one of the people who had advocated against for a street vacation, if it was done wisely. And the issue is that Swedish heard one thing and went the complete opposite direction. They took a seed and then did something completely different with it. So while on paper it may, you could say, well, this does reflect somewhat, there was no deeper level of communication or participation on our part other than them going away for a month or two and coming back with something that, if they had consulted with us and if they had been engaged in the process, perhaps we could have refined that or put them on a course that would have done a better job at balancing the needs of the institution and the needs of the neighborhood. Plan as is going to place a major institution in a residential neighborhood. There is no other major institution in Seattle that... There's no other major institution in Seattle that attempts to put as much intensity in a residential neighborhood as this plan. It is uncalled for. It is unheard of. It is an exception to what we consider to be good planning practice in the city. And the citizens of Seattle deserve better.
Thank you. Okay, do you have... Thank you, Mr. Richter. Do you have rebuttal? Either... No one? Right. Well, we got the briefing taken care of yesterday. Excuse me, I said I would address the record a little bit more today. I haven't been able to get in touch with the staff member who is over there at the council now. My guess is, at this point, what will happen with the record is that everything that's addressed to the CEPA case is marked as A, but as everyone noted, there are documents in the MIMP record that also have to do with the CEPA record. The entire record will end up being sent over to the council, and the land use attorney who will be staffing them for this particular one, I think, will be dealing with what goes to the council and what does not. And that's the way it went one of the last times that we did the MIMP. Before that, there was we want a definite separation. And so you should have no trouble over there if you're appealing. My recommendation, or ultimately in court with dealing with the record, should be something that everything is there that you need. So,
I just have a quick question. You said there will be a city council staffer who decides what goes to the council and what doesn't. Do we have any input on that?
How is that decision made? I don't know. It seems obvious that they will be trying to get as much to the council that relates to the MIMP, but not things that relate exclusively to CEPA, although, of course, they'll have the CEPA document there, the FEIS, to inform their own decision. So,
okay.
It's a behind-the-things scene. It usually, if there are issues that come up, I haven't finished.
Okay.
If there are issues that come up, that's I've never seen a situation where either applicants or if there were appellants were not able to contact the staff member and discuss it.
Okay.
If that that, then I guess we'll close the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify all the dates to make sure I have all the dates right, if that's all right. One last time. I don't want to inadvertently write something down or do something and then end up missing a time frame.
I didn't bring them with me, but go ahead. She's going to look for them.
Okay. My understanding is that the appellants submit something in writing to you no later than July 29th.
Correct.
And then the applicants have the opportunity to respond, which I anticipate they will, on August 5th.
Right.
And then we have till August 11th to reply if we so choose to do so.
Correct.
And that public comments can still be submitted until July 21st. And they have to be in your hands by then.
By 5 o'clock on July 21st. Yes. And if anyone is submitting proposed findings and conclusions, I think I said the 10th for those. Since the 11th is the last day for a reply brief, I'll put the proposed findings and conclusions on the 11th as well, if you want to submit them.
Can I ask you a question about that? You had indicated earlier that you would not really pay much attention to them, so I'm a little bit unsure.
We read them, and you know, we have in the past used a few of them. It really varies. Sometimes they come in as a real advocacy piece, and they're not useful. And sometimes they're quite straightforward, and they can be helpful.
Okay. It's just a lot. It's an enormous amount of work.
And so if you're going to do it, you want it to be useful, right?
Yeah, so yeah. I wanted to know what was useful to you. But you're saying the more neutral.
More straightforward. And focused, you know, really on things where you think there might be some details that we'll miss, that I'll miss, in reading through all the documents.
Okay.
So can I ask a technical question? This last one, the thing that we're talking about now, that would be due August, what day?
11, same day as the reply brief.
All right. How is that different than the responses?
Everything that you do is going to be, from an advocacy standpoint, you're advocating for a particular position.
Right.
And those are your briefs. The findings are not that, you know, this is an institution that's located on this street, da-da-da-da-da. It's just straight factual findings and then conclusions that flow from that. And in between that, if you have legal argument or legal citations, they're in there as well.
Okay.
It's not something that most pro se appellants do.
I understand. We had our own versions of that in previous work that I had.
Right.
And they're very long, tedious, and, yeah. I understand.
And usually I don't even allow appellants to do it on the MIMP, and I'm doing it here because Ms. Newman is concerned with the separation of the two things.
Thank you. I'm assuming we will all copy each other on what we submit.
Yes,
you
should.
So, can we do just portions, not an entire findings and conclusions on the other, but just one issue?
Yes.
Okay.
But if it is an advocacy piece, I won't even look at it.
Okay, I understand that.
And then one last question, because it is at this point in time where we are with that one piece that you were going to allow as it relates to the EIS concerning the stormwater piece. The update on that is this was you had asked if DPD would consider changing
the language.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And have you all discussed that?
Yes. They have. Well, we're working on it. They have submitted something to look at, and I have forwarded that to Mr. Kindred.
Okay. If you have something that you agree on, or if you don't, if you have two separate types of language that you would like to propose, then submit those. I would prefer to have those along with the first brief.
With the first briefs.
Right. Okay. 29.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Richter's comments from January 16th of 2015, those will be put into public testimony comments on the MIMP.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We appreciate your patience.
Well, I didn't have a choice.
Otherwise, we probably would have been popping out a long time ago.
Otherwise, I'd be writing something in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.